For those of you new folks, welcome to the 10th annual Gila River Festival, celebrating America's first wilderness river. I'm Allison Civic, Executive Director of the Gila Conservation Coalition. We're a partnership of three organizations that works to promote or protect, I should say, the free flow of the Gila River and the wilderness characteristics of the Gila and Aldo Leopold wilderness areas. GCC is made up of Gila Resources Information Project, Upper Gila Watershed Alliance, and the Center for Biological Diversity. It's great to be here. Lots of celebrations this year, lots of anniversaries. It's the 30th anniversary of the Gila Conservation Coalition, the 10th anniversary of the Gila River Festival, but it's the 90th anniversary of the Gila Wilderness and the 50th anniversary of the Wilderness Act. So all of these things are coming together in this year's Gila River Festival. So with that, let's get to it. We're really pleased. We've got a special addition to this year's Gila River Festival. Former Interstate Stream Commission Director Norm Gom is here with his colleagues, Jim Brainerd, retired from Sandia National Labs. He's a hydrologist. And Peter Koha, a retired engineer from Intel. And I've been told he's the Excel guru, expert. Jim's a decision support modeler. So they are going to give you the latest and greatest on their analysis, their modeling results of a Gila River diversion project. This is a very important year for the Gila River. By the end of the year, the state of New Mexico has to notify the Secretary of Interior if we're going to move forward with a diversion project. So for 10 years, there have been lots of studies going on. We're coming down to the 11th hour here. A lot of studies coming in. Norm and his team have been integral in really reviewing all of these engineering reports, cost reports, and providing us with a lot of terrific and critical analysis and information. And so there's the next Interstate Stream Commission meeting is Monday at 1:30, somewhere in Albuquerque. We still don't know where. And the Interstate Stream Commission is going to be making a decision in November. So we've got Monday's meeting and then one other meeting in October leading up to the decision. So all of this information is super important. And if you haven't already, special plug for writing your letter to Governor Martinez and tables on your way out. So please do that. So with that, Norm Gom, podium is yours. Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. And I guess I'd like to start by, in particular, thanking Allison and Todd, because without their support, we wouldn't be here today, and we wouldn't have learned all the things we've learned that I hope will be sufficient to stop this project in the state of New Mexico before it gets handed off to the feds at the end of the year. That's what we're trying to do. So Allison said that the Interstate Stream Commission will be making its decision in November. That was announced at its August meeting. And before that, nothing had been said about the decision process, which is yet another indication of how flawed the planning and decision process has been. It has been secretive, it's terribly flawed technically, and it's deceptive. We don't deserve this kind of government in the United States of America or the state of New Mexico, but that's what we're currently getting. And I will be specific a little bit more about that. I don't want to talk too long. My colleagues, my friends, Peter Koha and Jim Brainerd, have substantive things to tell you, but I wanted to tell you a little story maybe to place this. And I'll start very briefly with a little bit of my personal background. I went to grade school in Deming. Some of my earliest memories are coming to Silver City with my parents and picnicking on Cherry Creek and, you know, going to the Gila Wilderness and spending time at Willow Creek riding horses with my sister. And when I was in college, I started backpacking and I came across this very strange phenomena that I hadn't encountered before in my life, and that was a big river. And how the heck am I going to get across this? And once I crossed it, I said, well, how in the heck am I going to get back across it? But I said to myself, one day I'm going to take a boat, a canoe, down that river. So not very many years after that, I called one of my friends who was also a backpacker, and I said, hey, I'll buy a canoe if you'll go down the river with me. And somehow we made it. And I've done it many times previously, and it has been a true blessing in my life. I won't elaborate, but it means so much to me. I was appointed director of the Interstate Stream Commission by Governor Gary Johnson in 1997. I was director for 6 years. Toward the end of that period, we got a call from Senator Domenici's staff, who said that Senator Kyle needed to get enacted into federal law a settlement in Arizona that settled the water right claims of Arizona tribes. Really didn't have anything to do with New Mexico, except that Senator Domenici was aware that the legislation passed in 1968 that authorized the Central Arizona Project included the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project. And that's why we're here today. We are trying to stop the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project from being constructed. The first crack at that was Hooker Dam or suitable alternative. After that, it was Connor Dam. After that, it was Mangus Creek. And all of those failed. And they failed for good reasons. And those good reasons are even stronger today. You know, yet the state of New Mexico and the Interstate Stream Commission is pursuing an irrational course, you know, to try to figure out a way to get this to continue to move it forward. But I want to tell you about what Senator Domenici's opinion was back in the late 1990s, early 2000s. He said, this bill that Senator Kyle wants to have passed has to go through my committee, and we can get something for New Mexico. What do you want? And I said, money. Well, Senator Domenici appropriated $100 million to New Mexico in that bill. And two-thirds of it can be used on any project that meets a water supply demand in Catron, Grant, Hidalgo, and Luna counties. Any project. The other third can only be spent to construct the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project. And with what we know now, with a price tag of that project to over $1 billion, that $34 million is a poison pill. Here, take this $34 million so you can spend $1.1 billion. The important point is that Senator Domenici was studiously against in the bill saying the money could only go to build the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project, to get water out of the Gila. And I'm not going to go into all of the details, I don't have time, but he was studiously against that. Representative Pierce, on the other hand, demanded it. He wanted only a dam. The only thing the money could be spent for was a dam. But Domenici prevailed. And so there is $66 million now grown to $90 million that could be extended productively to basically take care of every drinking water system deficiency in the four-county area, completely. So the choice really is boondoggle to the extreme on one hand, or doing something practical with funds that Senator Domenici appropriated. So I'm going to jump forward to December of 2013. I retired at the end of 2002, and I refused to pay any attention to Gila water development planning that was going on, because I knew, because I know the Gila River, and I know what has to be done to develop, what would have to be done to develop water for it, that it's not possible. And so my friends, even though they were alarmed at what was going on, whenever they talked to me about it, I would say, don't worry, they can't do it. But enough of them said enough things to me that in December, I decided to go to the first Interstate Stream Commission that I had gone to in over 10 years. And I listened to Craig Repke, who has been leading the planning effort for the ISC, make a presentation to the ISC. And I was quite alarmed with what I heard, because the information that was conveyed was non-substantive, and the commission had no substantive discussion. You know, it was like a different planet from the Interstate Stream Commission when I was the director, and everything was discussed extensively in open public meetings, and that's the way policy was set. So I went up to Craig after the meeting and I asked him, have you solved the CUFA puzzle? Well, CUFA is the Consumptive Use and Forbearance Agreement, and it has an extremely complicated and difficult set of constraints on diversion. And it was my view that unless New Mexico could get out from under those constraints, their project was effectively impossible. He didn't answer me. He said, I want you to come see me. So on December 12th, I went up to Santa Fe, and I met with Craig and all of his staff in my old office, you know, in the corner of the Batan building. And Craig started showing me PowerPoint slides. And the more slides he showed me, the more suspicious I got. And then when he showed me these snippets of his model, he called it, you know, just little snippets, cartoons, if you will, of the results, you know, my reaction to that was, may I have a copy of your model, please? And he turned wary and he said, well, the output? And I said, no, the model. Well, he didn't give it to me then, and talked to him again and was pretty clear I wasn't going to get it. So I filed a public records request. And the short story is I was refused. And I think I was refused unlawfully. But the funny thing is that the Interstate Stream Commission inadvertently gave me the model at the same time they had refused to give it to me. So I have it. And I'm just going to fast forward to where we are now. So one of the things I really wanted to do, Craig's spreadsheet was just chock full of errors, and it doesn't say anything useful about how much water you might get out of the project. It just talks about the maximum water that you might be able to divert if you had your act together perfectly. Well, that's a far cry from finding usable water. And so I really wanted to model the Gila River and the water that could be produced under the constraints of the Consumptive Use and Forbearance Agreement. I tried to get some funding and talked to my friends, and the Gila Conservation Coalition came through and has actually sponsored the work that we're doing, including buying some really expensive modeling software that Jim will show you. I obtained a license for Sandia National Laboratories decision support tool that cost the taxpayers $680,000, in which the Interstate Stream Commission then abandoned. Apparently, this is my opinion, because they didn't like the results, but I never did hear a real concrete reason. We didn't use the Sandia model. Jim may get into that, but there was a lot of information in that was useful to us. But all of this came together just 2 days ago, when Peter and Jim and I met with Craig Repke and his staff at the ISC offices in Albuquerque, and we blew them away. Craig left the meeting when he found out that we had his secret model and that we had found out it was full of errors. Even though I told him that half a dozen times since we got it, apparently he didn't believe it. His staff was glued to Jim's computer screens, looking at the simulation of how much water you might actually get out. And I'll save that story for Jim, but it was fun to be sitting in the back of the room and watching all of that. So that's an overview story of how we came to be here today. And I am indebted to the dedication of my good friends who've worked with me, and I am sure that we will prevail.
My name is Peter Cohen. I'd like to thank Allison and the Gila River Festival for the opportunity to speak here today and share this information with you, because it's really good information. Jim and I kind of broke up our activity to look at the divertible water. I was tasked to look at the model, correct the model that ISC had used, to get kind of the best model based on the CUFA agreement, which is pretty complex. And Jim then was, once we had calculated that divertible model, we fed that information into PowerSim and did the calculation to see how much usable water there would be. So first of all, a couple of definitions. Secret spreadsheet, that really refers to Craig's basic model. It was actually loaded with data up through 2002, so it wasn't even current at the time. I extended it with data from the USGS, which you can download all that gauge data for both the gauges and the reservoir, and I extended it through 2013, actually up to 2014. And then I went through it and corrected it, basically, column by column to make sure that it was following CUFA to the best of my ability. So the context is, one hand, I need to kind of commend the ISC for doing all the analysis that they've done, but I don't think what they did, they kind of missed the primary function that they really needed to be doing is addressing water. They were looking at endangered species, a lot of other side tangential issues, but not necessarily looking at how much water would be available once they put in a diversion project. So there was no publicly available information on that. So that's what Norm obviously decided we needed to go look at. All through the process, everyone's understood that the river is really sporadic, and anyone who's been around Gila knows that you get massive floods, and then it's relatively dry for longer periods of time. Well, we'll look at that and show you that in the data today. When I first got involved, and I came relatively late to the game, Norm invited me to work with him to do data analysis, which, as a retired semiconductor Intel engineer, I was really excited about that. So what I heard, though, was 14,000 acre feet average per year would be available. And that's kind of based on the 10-year, 140,000 year average that would be available under CUFA. But actually, if you look at it and you start to run the numbers, well, it's more like 12,000, between 12,000 and 12,500, which is already an 11% drop from the 14,000. Water's starting to disappear pretty quickly. And all that water that disappears will just increase the overall acre foot delivery cost to that water. So in doing the analysis, there was good news that the spreadsheets, once I did get them, they were relatively close. However, the calculated acre footage of 12,423 was 11% less. And it's available sporadically and in many years not at all. So the process that I used basically was to research the consumptive use, the CUFA, which again is a fairly complex model, lots of conditions that you need to understand the interrelationships and how those apply to water usage and diversion, maximums, minimums. Then use the existing models, formatted those for comparison so that I could make sure that I wasn't going astray in my analysis. And then extended with the USGS water gauges, then did the corrections and the analysis, and then provided the input into the PowerSim model. Here's an example of the chart which I used to look at the CUFA between three different models, and actually I also had the benefit of the TNC did some analysis, and so I used them as a comparison point for looking at doing some of that modeling comparison. Some of the issues that we found were they looked at the previous day's gauge data, which the gauges and the water flow is so sporadic that you might, if you're looking at that to gauge what you should be diverting, you could actually be missing the diversion that you should have been catching. 30,000 acre feet threshold was applied incorrectly. San Carlos is part of the equation here, where they, at the beginning of the year, they expect to have a particular volume, 30,000 acre foot, in that reservoir. And so that was being applied incorrectly. 140,000 acre foot wasn't calculated on a calendar year, which again, all of these just kind of throw little deviations into the amount of divertible water. And then what is really surprising is the water that is diverted here has to be prepaid as part of a water bank and delivered to the downstream customers before water is actually diverted. And so there's, it's called the pre-bank or the water bank. And so that's pretty surprising. And just that fact, but secondly, that wasn't being reduced correctly. So many errors in their spreadsheet. This shows the legally divertible water over a 77-year period. I calculated the mean and the median over there. You can see the median, 50% over and under, is way lower than the average. This chart represents is the blue lines are the amount of Gila near Gila annual flow minus the Kufa, and the red are the Kufa diversions that are calculated to be okay. And you can see here that just because we have, certainly you see that, yes, when we have high water there, you know, we divert a lot sometimes, but not all the time. Sometimes there are other limitations that are kicking in that are actually stopping water diversion. So just because we have a lot of water in the river doesn't necessarily mean that we're able to divert. And you can also see here there are many years where there's not very much divertible water. Divertible water is very low. Looking at the distribution of it, again, you can see when water is relatively low, we're not going to divert much. But just because we do have water doesn't mean we're able to divert much water due to other limitations. Here's just looking at the diverted water. You can see many years, very low, no or very low legally divertible water. So looking at the extreme variability, what I did, I created a histogram here in 5,000 acre-feet bins. And you can see here that extreme variability, nearly half the flows, there's basically no divertible water once you start to put in some of the mitigation factors. 18 years, you know, there's no diversion whatsoever. 17 years had less than 25,000. And that's about the threshold that what they want to do is a mitigation flow of 10 CFS, and that equals that mitigation flow. So that means that effectively you won't have that water available for anything else other than that mitigation flow. And then the other surprise and the flip side of that is 3 years, you know, 4% of the years delivered 64,000 acre feet. So that means those years are going to disproportionately contribute to the mean annual yield statistic. The top chart shows the contribution of the annual volumes based on those on these bins, 0 to 5,000. 14,000, 30,000, 43,000, 16,000, 64,000. And you can kind of see again, this is to show you that very few rare years provide the most period of record of divertible water. So 3 years provides 20% of the water, 30% is provided the five biggest years, and 68% is 15 biggest years. 18 years, no divertible water, and then 42 years is less than 5K of divertible water. So of course, this is going to show that, you know, when we do have water available in the river, if we want to have that water spread out and provide it to folks in a uniform, continuous way, you have to build your systems to be able to accommodate that. So here I've mapped our overall chart showing our divertible water for every year to the black lines show the diversions that occurred during that year. So what you see here is that there are 6 years where there was no divertible water whatsoever. So that means, you know, if you're going to have a reservoir that's going to be distributing water for 6 years of drought, it probably won't happen because your reservoir probably will not have diverted that much water, and your reservoir probably wouldn't be able to hold that water, to be large enough to hold that water. And then we have, you know, four-year periods where there was, again, very little water, and two-year periods. So the water supply will be difficult to maintain during those periods. That's kind of the main point there. This is really, you know, where my task of calculating that divertible water ended. And so I am going to provide this information. We shared it with the ISC on Tuesday, but we'll go ahead and provide this. I have provided it to them formally, and I'll provide that to them on the ISC meeting this Monday. One thing that I also calculated that was actually a table of diversion events. So not only do we have you know, those charts, but as I put together the data, I put together charts so that we have yearly summaries and event summaries so that we can look at that level of detail, showing, you know, what the trigger event was that caused that diversion to start, and also end. You know, what were the primary indicators of that. And in conclusion, you know, feast or famine, flood or drought, need to be able to store the water from the feast years to get through the famine years. And then, you know, just as casual observation, it seems like CUFA was written to preclude New Mexico diversion much of the time. So, you know, even with different calculations, there was little bottom line difference, little bottom line impact, because I think the restraints were so, there were such common restraints on New Mexico diverting water. CUFA defines, you know, any additional water rights are junior with many restrictions and limits on the amount that can be diverted. And even with this, any diverted water under this agreement needs to be paid forward to the senior right water holders right downstream. What does that mean? That means that water has to be planned in what they call a water bank, pre-banked, and it actually has to be delivered prior to usage and diversion, prior to diversion, and then once that diversion occurs, that's reduced off that water bank. And I think there might be some times where the water bank has run out of money, has run out of water, which has caused some diversions to turn off. That's one of the constraints. Will a law be beneficial to the downstream Arizona users? I think to them it's a net equal. Yeah, because they're going to get the water regardless. And it's going to be paid, and actually have to be piped back up into a distribution canal above their usage.
So there's no real benefit to New Mexico in the final analysis, even though they intended it to be, quote.
Yeah, I would say that there's probably very little benefit, yes. Well, and let Jim talk, because then it starts to become even more ludicrous, because you'd start to deal with the losses. And I'm just talking about diversion here. And he's going to talk about how that percentage of diversion that's going to turn into net usable water.
In the Bill Evans diversion that already exists, is that being used and as planned? And are there any problems existing in that diversion?
I'm going to let Norm, let's hand the mic to Norm.
Hey, Norm Gump.
The Bill Evans diversion is very, very different than what would be built than the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project. The Bill Evans diversion relies on very senior water rights. You know, that means they can pump when the water is clear and low and easy to deal with. You know, they can pump it up into Bill Evans Lake, and it goes then on up to supply the mines. And that is super easy and super cheap, compared to the enormous challenges, almost impossibilities, that would exist to build the project that the Interstate Stream Commission is deciding on. I mean, if Silver City really needed water, Bill Evans Lake is not being used to its full capacity. Be easy and cheap to get some of that water compared to building this billion-dollar project that, as Jim will show you, has very little benefit.
One last question for Peter.
So if the actual diversion is ended up being built, the storage is built, it would have to comply with the ESA, Endangered Species Act, which could also affect its operations. Did this model take into account what those would look like, or that even be more of a reason that this would be very sporadic water?
Yeah, there would be a full ESA study on it, and yes, as part of the plan, they have 150 minimum CFS that they will not divert when it's less than that. And they also, in the last ISC meeting, came up with this kind of 10 CFS release to actually keep water in the river so it actually doesn't dry out.
My name is Jim Brainerd. It's a pleasure to be here today. So I'm going to present some modeling results from a platform called Systems and Dynamic, coming from a PowerSim software platform. And I'm wondering how many of you people have seen the Sandia decision support model? Just a couple, okay. It's a Sandia decision support model. It's a model that's put together by Sandia National Labs to sort of water, large water budget model for the Membris and the Gila and the San Francisco rivers. And it was probably finished up in 2010 or so. Most of the work took place with it in 2004 to 2007, I believe. So just a few people. So I just kind of wanted to get an idea as to how familiar I was with the software that I was using, so I know how much detail to go into. So the title of this talk is A Model for Determining Usable Water from Two Gila River Diversion and Storage Alternatives. And the key words up there are model, or model, and also usable water. You know, these hydrologic systems are very complex, and we use models to help us understand what happens and how these things operate. And when you perturb them by taking water out of the system, putting them in reservoirs, it changes that system. And these models really help us to understand what those impacts are. And the other word is usable water. Now, what Peter showed you was the amount of water that can be diverted. And what I'm going to show you is the usable water. And so something happens between the time it's diverted until the time it's brought back into the system somewhere. And that's what I'm going to cover today. So it's not surprising that we would be talking about the main objective of this project is to quantify usable project water. And that water is water that would be made available for supplemental irrigation and export to Deming. And then also the other objective is to illustrate the impact of project losses on usable water. And so I have a few word slides I'm going to go through here, and then we'll get to a picture slide, and then I'm going to show you some modeling results. So sort of hang with me on the word slides. We're going to sort of show you what kind of effort it took to put this model together. So what we want to do is, what we did in this model was to simulate diversions of peak flows to storage reservoirs in accordance with legal restrictions, and that's what you saw in Peter's presentation, the legal restrictions and the resulting diversions. And simulate reservoir releases, and there's two categories. One is augmented low flows for supplemental irrigation and also for environmental mitigation. And then also water for denning, 2,500 acre feet per year. And then also to simulate project losses. And you know, there's diversion losses where you can't get all of the water out of the river that you are allocated. This might happen because there's large floods that come through and clog up the works, or maybe they shut down the intakes preemptively when big storms are expected to come through and when that river kicks up to 10, 20, 30,000 CFS, cubic feet per second. And then seepage and evaporation losses are also of very much consideration. The other diversion losses is actually spilling the water out of the conveyance system to get rid of the sand and sediment that may collect there during the high floods or peak flows. So, as I alluded to, the model was built in PowerSim Studio, and it's a pretty impressive piece of software. And I'm not a salesperson for PowerSim Studios.
And actually, tomorrow afternoon, we're going to be in the auditorium out here, and I'd really like the opportunity to show you guys how flexible and easy it is to work with the software, and at the same time, show you some of the insides of the model. I'm going to simplify the talk a little bit here today, just because it's difficult to, you know, talk about it in any great detail and go back and forth on question with questions. But anyway, this model platform simulates time series data. And the input data is from, like I said, from Peter's output. And it's in the form of time series all over 1937 to 2013. So it's diversion in cubic feet per second. And this model accumulates those flows pretty much like you might in a bathtub. When you turn on the faucet and the bathtub fills up, and the bathtub will continue to fill up until you pull the plug on it. So it's what hydrologists call a mass balance model. You track the movement of water through the system. And there are some real advantages to this model. You can track feedbacks between the reservoir and the input. If you have a full reservoir, you can't put any more water in there. If you have an empty reservoir, you can't take any water out. And all that, those things are considered in the model also. And then also there's a very friendly user interface where you can just change variables rather quickly and run the model over and over again while looking at the results. And so you can sort of do a sensitivity analysis on your parameters and find out which parameters impact, you know, the results the most, and hence you understand what the importance of those parameters are. And then I think I alluded to the graphical comparison. So we actually built two models, one of the Mogollon Creek, proposed Mogollon Creek Reservoir. We did that because I think Norm said that Deming brought up the idea of using the Mogollon Reservoir for their diversions as one of the more attractive cases. And also it was in a Bureau of Reclamation report as one of the alternatives. And then the other model that we put together was for the Sycamore and Greenwood Canyon reservoirs. And those reservoirs are attractive because they can store larger volumes of water. I think the Mogollon Canyon would store about 11,000 acre feet, and the Sycamore Greenwood could store 60,000 acre feet. All right, so here's sort of the guts of the model. And the bathtub is that right there. So if things come into the bathtub, as indicated by these arrows, like that arrow there, and things come out of the bathtub, such as indicated by this arrow here. And you notice that hidden inside these symbols are the equations that the model runs on. And so when I'm modeling, I double click on that thing, and it brings up a window, and in there is the equation. And then these lines indicate that these other variables are connected to that variable. And you notice how there's a line that comes from the reservoir back to this input variable. That's called a feedback. And you'll notice there's lines going down. Okay, so now let me tell you what these things are. So here's this reservoir inflow. Here's the outflow in terms of evaporation. Here's the outflow in terms of reservoir releases. And here's the outflow in terms of seepage. And you can tell that I've also tracked the total amount of evaporation by this little box up here, and the total amount of seepage. And so here's part of the user interface that makes it pretty easy to work with. If I wanted to change the storage capacity of this reservoir, all I have to do is grab that slider bar and slide it to the left, and run the model again and see how that might impact the results. Okay, so I'd like to, you know, just to show you that building these models involves more than just sitting down at the computer and putting information in. If we had perfect information, building these models would be easy, but we don't. And so we really have to work hard to get the data, make sense of the data, and use it in the model in a way that makes sense. I don't know if I'm going to go through all this. You know, the things we consider was location, storage capacity, full pool elevation, reservoir surface area at full pool, and reservoir inflow, open water evaporation, seepage parameter, also called the hydraulic conductivity, hydrogeologic parameters, and there I'm talking about thicknesses of aquifers, thicknesses of sediments, and things like that, and reservoir release assumptions. And so the two assumptions that are primary as far as releases go are the 2,500 acre feet per year for damming and 10 CFS for supplemental irrigation and for environmental mitigation. So it's a total of 20 cubic feet per second. So one of the things we had to do was simplify the model quite a bit. On the left up here is sort of a more realistic conceptual model than what we actually implemented in the model. So what I've got drawn in here is sort of a representation of the Mogollon Reservoir. The pink here is a Gila conglomerate. There's the alluvial aquifer. That's all the gravels that you find in the bottom of the stream bed or in stream beds. And then the reservoir would be on top of the alluvial aquifer. And really, how water flows out of these things is that it doesn't go straight down, and it doesn't go straight sideways. It goes down and out, like this. And that's a pretty complex model to simulate. And you can't do that kind of stuff in PowerSim Studio because it's not a two-dimensional or three-dimensional flow model. All it does is accumulate and send things out of whatever you accumulated. So we had to use this equation here called Darcy's Law, and apply it to a very simple case where water is driven through this part of the helical conglomerate down to what we call the regional aquifer, and that's represented by the blue here. And all this is actually the helical conglomerate, but here it doesn't have water in it until we put the reservoir on top, and then the water feeds down in there. And so what we really want to do is apply that equation over this part of the helical conglomerate that in this picture is shown as being unsaturated or doesn't have water in it. And so these equations here just show, so this says that the flow is equal to the hydraulic conductivity minus the hydraulic conductivity times the cross-section area times the gradient across that, the pressure gradient, or total gradient across that. And then that gradient consists of a pressure head, two pressure heads, and two gravitational heads. And you can put numbers into these equations and come out with, you know, with your pen and pencil, you can just come out with, a value for the gradient. But the take-home message here is that the water flow here is in one-dimensional. It is one-dimensional. It does not go out to the sides like what you see here. And therefore, this is a more conservative way to model the system than it is to incorporate lateral flow out of the reservoir. So in other words, this is probably going to underestimate. If everything else is all right in the model, this is going to underestimate the total amount of water coming out of the reservoir. So now let's do some results. So on the left up here is the result of a simulation that where the hydraulic conductivity was equal to 0.01 feet per day. Now, as far as the sandstorm goes, that's probably down in the lower end of a typical hydraulic conductivity for sandstones. They can go up to 10 feet per day, and if they're really unconsolidated and they got gravels mixed in, they go up to a couple of hundred feet per day. So this is a pretty, fairly low. It's not the lowest, but it's somewhat low. And it's within the range of what all these references that I showed you earlier have suggested that the hydraulic conductivity of the helical conglomerate might be. Over on the right here is the same simulation, except with a hydraulic conductivity set at 1 foot per day. So now we've increased the permeability of the sediments, and there should be more water coming out of the system. Okay, so this plot here is reservoir storage volume versus time, so 1937 to 2013, and this plot is exactly the same as that. And so what you see here is this is a simulation that's already been ran. What you see here is that the reservoir volume, goes up and down, up and down, up and down. So it's full some of the time, but it's empty a lot of the time. And this is this little period over here where Peter mentioned where there was no water in the reservoir for 6 years or something like that. I mean, there was no diversion allowed for 4 to 6 years. And so it's always nice when you find your model is consistent with other people's work. Okay, so at 0.01 cubic foot per day, it doesn't look too bad. It looks like there's some water in there, and maybe you can get some out. But at 1 foot per day, the reservoir doesn't hardly even fill. And the reason why this line is here is because we started with a full reservoir. I have a setting in there to set the initial conditions for the reservoir full. And that thing just drops down and then and then there's these little jags up and down. Now, and so the question is, what is driving the system? Why is there no water in this reservoir a lot of the times? You know, it's a hydraulic conductivity that's causing this thing to drain so much. Okay, so the other thing we can look at is, so same model run. You think I would learn that, huh? Same model run, it's, you know, 0.01 foot per day of hydraulic conductivity over here, 1 foot per day of hydraulic conductivity over here. And now we're looking at volume versus time for the reservoir release by category. Now hidden in here is three categories that I spoke of: supplemental irrigation, environmental mitigation, and export to demming. And you notice that, you know, on a lot of the years, it looks like demming actually gets their 2,500 acre feet per year. And the other releases, the supplemental mitigation, sort of vary throughout the years on this one. It doesn't look like demming gets much water at all. You know, a lot of times they don't get any. In fact, they didn't get any over here in that little period that we spoke of a few moments ago, that dry period. And here they're only getting about 1,000 acre feet per day when they do get it at best. And then down here, this is something called foregone diversions due to full reservoir. Here, there's a lot of water they couldn't capture because the reservoir is full. And this is their argument for having larger reservoirs. Because if you have a larger reservoir, you can capture more water. Now over here on the right, you notice that there are no foregone diversions at all because the reservoir is full and you couldn't put any more water in because the reservoir wasn't ever full. So the take-home point here is that hydraulic conductivity is a very important parameter. All right, so these are bar plots, and on the left is volume once again in acre feet. So it's 1 million acre feet, the maximum on this one here. This is a 0.01 foot per day case. This is a 1 foot per day case, and these two are exactly the same. These numbers down here correspond to the categories above them. Let's see, so let me explain a little bit more. So these are the conveyance losses over here that I spoke of. Those are, you know, losses that you can't, where you can't get water into the conveyance system because of floods, because of operator error, so on and so forth. This is the water that went by because the reservoir is full. This is water lost to evaporation. This is water lost to seepage. And these three categories are the water lost, or the water released from the reservoirs. So as far as losses in the reservoir, out of the reservoir directly, these are the numbers we're concerned with. These two numbers here, seepage and evaporation. As far as diversion losses, these are the two categories we want to look at. And so I bet you most of you have probably looked down here at the lower plot, and you've already seen the seepage goes right through the roof on this. And one thing we can say about the conveyance losses is it actually have that set to such that the model accepts all of the water out of the CUFA. And we did that just to say, well, once again, we're being conservative. We're saying this is the best case scenario for these guys, you know, for building the dams. So that's why there's nothing here. The conclusions of this whole exercise and modeling are that seepage of the Gila conglomerate is of major concern. The uncertainty presents a high risk of project failure. Just in the last couple of days, the Bohannon and Houston folks came out with a proposal for other reservoirs and diversions, and they want to line the ponds. This would certainly take care of seepage, except it's my understanding and our understanding that lining is very expensive. There's no previous installations in dry, flash film, large reservoirs. And my guess is that the maintenance of those things are going to be very problematic, and also maybe they might last 25, 50 years, you have to reline the reservoir again. Keep in mind that if you really want to dig down the model, we'll be really glad to do it. We're going to set up two large screens, you know, computer screens, and I'll sit there and show you the insides of the model and take you as far much into it as you want. And thank you very much for your attention.
Let me just take a couple of minutes to try to tie this together for you so that you understand the situation and what we're thinking. First of all,
I find it unconscionable that the Interstate Stream Commission hasn't done a modeling analysis like this. Their mission in law is to investigate water resources. The way they have performed that mission for this particular project is that they've built a spreadsheet of the water that's legally available for diversion. They've kept it a secret. It's full of errors. They've said nothing about the erratic nature of the water availability. How many years are dry? The 20% of the water over the period of record 77 years came in only 3 years, but they take those 3 years and they show it as an average 12,000 acre feet per year. It's baloney. Worse, they haven't said a word about usable water. In their speeches, they would have you believe that 14,000 acre feet is the amount of water that we're talking about, which really isn't much to begin with, but in reality, you know, on average, it's going to be a very low number. They don't tell you that in many years there will be no water at all. So the model results that Peter prepared, the spreadsheet, shows the water that's available every year, but it actually shows the water that's available every day. And it is so sporadic. What was the statistic, Peter, that diversions occur less than 10% of the days in a year? You're going to be paying an operator, an operations and maintenance staff, good money to be waiting all year long. Well, we didn't get a diversion this year. We didn't get one this next year either. Well, maybe one will come this year and we'll be able to work for a day or a week or a month. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And on the other end, there's been zero analysis of the usable water that would come out of this. And those two things together just blow me away. It is not the way these projects should be planned. It's deceptive, it's secretive, it's wrong. It's wrong.
We'll take a couple questions for Norm and Jim and Peter.
The bottom line is, as I can see it, is who does that when they finally make their decision, and let's say they make their decision for a diversion, who do they have to convince with these numbers or their numbers? I mean, they have to go to the feds. Am I correct on an understanding? And who do they have to convince in that bureaucracy of that we call government?
That's an excellent question. If the Interstate Stream Commission votes to send a letter to the Secretary of Interior, and it need only be one sentence long, we want to proceed to build the New Mexico unit of the Central Arizona Project. Sincerely yours, Interstate Stream Commission. It then goes into the federal environmental law compliance process. So we're talking about the National Environmental Policy Act with an environmental impact statement, Endangered Species Act compliance, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Coordination Act, Clean Water Act. It's really going to be quite an involved process. And back in 2008, Todd asked the Bureau of Reclamation a question. What did they expect the Interstate Stream Commission would have done by now to set the stage for this extremely expensive and long federal review? And the reply was that they would have expected the Interstate Stream Commission to evaluate the cost, the water, the environmental impact, and any other aspect of the project that might be a fatal flaw, so as to assure against the feds finding a fatal flaw. Sorry, they haven't gotten there at all. So the federal government is going to be faced with the handoff of a bunch of mush from the state of New Mexico, and they're going to have to figure out what they're going to do with it, and I don't know how they will begin. Now what the law says, what the Arizona Water Settlement Act says, is that the Secretary of the Interior must sign a record of decision, which is the end step in a federal environmental impact statement process. And so the Secretary of the Interior has to sign off on that by the end of 2019. Well, 5 years is a long time, but it's not a long time to deal with something like this. Now, the Secretary of the Interior can extend that deadline only if the delays are no fault of the state of New Mexico. Well, guess what? I mean, they just haven't done their job. That's all there is to it. Maybe say one more thing. I mean, I'm optimistic. I don't think this project will ever be built. I think the federal government will do a professional job. I hope they will. But that's not certain, number one. And number two, that money that I talked about that would be available to do good things, guess where the money to pay the Fed's bill is going to come from? It's going to come out of that money, and they could easily spend $10 million of that money before they give up and say, okay, well, you can use what's left to do things that make sense.
Okay, so a couple of questions. Under either one of those models, have you all worked out a final number of how much average annual usable or deliverable water is going to come out?
I wish we could have, but we have not, because we don't know what the hydraulic conductivity underneath the reservoirs is. What we can say is if it's this, you don't get any water.
Sure.
If it's as good as it could possibly be, well, maybe you get 4,000 acre feet, but not in all years. You know, and we're going to get that written up. Now, I'm very pessimistic that the Interstate Stream Commission will pay any attention to that, because they're not about investigation and facts and the right decision. For whatever reason, and it blows my mind, they're on a completely different planet.
Okay, also, is there a project life that's anticipated for either one of those models? Like, was that a 50-year reservoir life, 75-year?
50-year, I think.
Thank you.
You've alluded to it just now, but I'm wondering what you believe the political realities are right now on the Interstate Stream Commission in regard to this.
Well, even though the Interstate Stream Commission will tell you nothing has been decided, we haven't made up our minds, and you know, it's not the truth. So the only way that this project will be stopped within the state of New Mexico, I think, is if the governor weighs in. And I think that there is a chance for the governor to realize that her people are moving a $1 billion boondoggle forward, and that if she has any political ambitions, that might not be a good thing for her. That's the only way I see to stop it.
One of the things that's been so distressing to me in this, watching this whole process, I've only been in New Mexico for 3 years, but I've been following this battle. One of the things that's really disturbed me has been the lack of really thorough journalism into what is going on. Now, there have been certain articles that mostly got it right, but it's just too bad, and it's a truism that whoever gets out front and defines the terms first, that's what the public seems to catch on to, that, oh, well, there's this 14,000 acre feet of new water, and we have to get it or it's going to flow on to Arizona. It's so rare that any of these articles have really pointed out that, first of all, it's not free water, it's not New Mexico's water, and it's going to cost a lot of money. And I just wish, we all know that journalism is not funded like it should be, but I would certainly hope that some major stories would come out about this. And on a side light, this whole notion of a secret model and, you know, those kinds of things are just truly disturbing. So do you have any optimism that somehow the truth will get out?
I do have optimism. And we're doing everything we can to generate accurate news reporting.
How do you gentlemen expect your presentation to the ISC will be welcomed on Monday?
Well, Peter and Jim already know. Peter, in public comments to the Interstate Stream Commission on August 26th, asked for time on the agenda, and he followed that up with a detailed email to the Interstate Stream Commission director, who waited a long time and then replied that Jim and Peter would have to present their results to Craig, for Craig to review the model and the results, which is what we did last Tuesday. And Jim and Peter did a superb job. And I talked to the Interstate Stream Commission director yesterday, and neither Peter nor Jim are on the agenda. I have 10 minutes. And I will say what I can. Our plan is to hold a news conference outside the ISC meeting room doors to explain to any reporters that we can attract to the meeting and anybody else who's interested in hearing what the ISC has chosen not to hear.
This was asking, it's not a public meeting.
It is a public meeting. And if I had time, I would expand on that. The only thing to say here is it is an open public meeting. The Open Meetings Act in New Mexico is a very powerful law. I don't believe the Interstate Stream Commission has complied with it. I believe it's possible to hold them accountable for that. But the Open Meetings Act doesn't give anybody a right to talk. It only says that they have to do their talking in public.
Join me in thanking Norm Gom, Peter Kola. I want to say this is really a tremendous effort on the part of all three of you to really get this done in a very, very short amount of time. And I think, as I've said throughout the course of today, we've got reports that are coming in. Like, literally, we just got one report yesterday. I don't even know if it has the information that you guys need, like on seepage hydraulic conductivity. But tremendous effort to have pulled this together so quickly. And this is moving very quickly. Thank you very much.